Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Anne DePrince, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Denver. And we discuss the work around community-engaged scholarship. What is that? What does that really mean? And how can we best support universities in collaborating with communities so that we're ultimately producing the best science possible? So grab your drink of choice. I'll have my coffee and stay tuned for this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Thank you so much for being here and being willing to talk with me today. So I like to just start with who's in the room and who's in the conversation. So can you give an introduction to who you are and sort of what work you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me today, Katie. My name is Anne DePrince. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Denver. I direct a research group that we call the Traumatic Stress Studies Group, and we study violence against women and girls, among other types of trauma. But in recent years, our focus has really been intimate violence, looking at things like sexual assault, domestic violence, trafficking, and so forth. I also am Associate Vice Provost for Public Good Strategy and Research at the University of Denver here in Colorado. And in that role, I try to support the university in terms of collaborations with the community to advance discovery. And that certainly is a passion of mine through my own work in terms of collaborating with community partners to get to the best of science and practice.
That topic of connecting community and research has been one that has been coming up a lot in the conversations I've been having. So I wonder if you can speak a bit to, like, from your perspective and from your leadership, especially in a university setting, why you see that as being such an important role for you as, like, I would say maybe like an engaged scholar or someone who works on a community side and sits in an academic space as well.
Well, I think the university has such an important part to play in public problem solving, and yet we can't do that alone, and we shouldn't. That communities have the best perspectives on what issues are priorities and what potential solutions are possible. And then we, as academics, as researchers, as scholars, have an opportunity to bring science to bear on that problem solving. And so that synergy between community and university, in my experience, has really been where the magic is in terms of advancing our field's understanding in a way that's also ready for policy and practice implications, not in some distant future, but doing work that can have impact really in real time.
Absolutely. So one of the ways, and I'm hoping we'll kind of come back to that idea, because I think scholarship and community is such an area of growth, such an area of sustainability that can be seen in those connections, as well as growth for learning. Like, there's just a lot that's yet to be really understood how we envision that work moving forward. But before we get there, I wonder if you could talk a bit about kind of what led you to the work you do, but specifically the intersections or inroads that kind of shaped your career or the perspective you have today. Because one of the things that I hope these conversations illuminate is that there are various ways in which scholarship and research addresses or views the field of violence and violence prevention and service provision. We say it as an area, but like, there's just so many ways that folks come at it. And so much, at least in my understanding, and maybe that could be different, there's moments in the pathway to becoming who you are now as a researcher that intersect and kind of address and shape that perspective. And so I know that was a lot of a question, but really to both hear your pathway, because getting into academia is usually not someone's initial first. This was always what I wanted to do. But then also, if you could speak a bit to like where those things intersected to be like, you know what, this is how I address the problem and this is how I see it.
Yeah, that pathway question is such an important one because it does really inform a lot of the decisions we make, as you're saying. So I discovered a passion for psychology as well as for thinking about violence against women and violence against children sorts of issues when I was in college. And then I did a couple of years working in more public education for a nonprofit around child abuse. And just that the passion stayed with me around the potential for research to really inform our understanding understanding of such an important public problem and what to do about it. So I went off to graduate school at the University of Oregon, and my mentor there was Dr. Jennifer Fried. And she and I together started out with her studying really a lot of cognitive questions about memory for trauma, processing of traumatic experiences. And over time, I got more and more interested in how people make sense of traumatic experiences like violence, things that can be common in the aftermath, like alienation or shame or betrayal. And I was also a clinical psychology student. So I was getting clinical training at the same time and trying to figure out how to connect what I was seeing in a lot of lab-based studies to what I was learning about clinical practice in the real world. And I went off to my internship year at University of Washington Medical Center, and I saw trauma, particularly intimate violence, coming up on every rotation I did, whether it was a rehab unit or an inpatient unit. And that was all those kind of interconnections and the various ways that trauma shows up was a very important part of my early development as a scholar. So fast forward, I end up at the University of Denver in the Department of Psychology. And I really here in building my research team, we talked a lot about how to do research that mattered. And to us on the team, what that meant was research that could both advance our scientific understanding while also having these implications for community problem solving. I realized the best way to do that was through partnership. And so started working with community-based agencies, law enforcement, the Denver DA's office, and my team really over the years, early on, we had this motto, we called it returning research to the community. And it was this sort of homegrown value for us that research starts with the community. Participants come from different communities. They share their perspectives, their stories, their survey responses, and that we as researchers have a responsibility to return that back to where information can be used. That early value really guided then how much we invested in, and we're fortunate that folks were willing to invest back in us, invested in partnerships in order to carry out the kind of work that I do now.
Yeah, it's interesting. Social science research sort of feels as if it's making a bit of a rotation back to understanding its purpose, maybe. And again, certainly this is just my perspective, but there's a lot of attention paid to wanting legitimacy in an academic space, right? The higher education and the academy hold a lot of power and hierarchy and sort of gatekeeping around what's science and legitimacy and higher learning in those ways. Social sciences wants to be considered in, right, that we do ethical, reliable, quantifiable research. And there's almost a stepping back again. Now that legitimacy, I think, has been at least more well-rooted, a step back to try to remember or be reminded of like, oh, right, we are from a very individual looking at social problems and social ills, which are people-oriented and change-oriented and don't necessarily care too much about whether or not we're considered legitimate in these other spaces. Of course, that's important, right? We want to do no harm and all of those things. But on a community level, there definitely feels like I'm having more and more conversations with folks who are asking these important questions of like, how do we recenter community and recenter that the work is meant to impact rather than recentering maybe what was a very needed battle in another moment, maybe to like get that academic standing. It's encouraging to keep having those conversations.
Yeah, I think it's true. And you see this across fields too, not only in the violence field, but that there is a growing recognition across disciplines that university community collaboration is in and of itself part of a methodological approach that is rigorous and is an important way of knowing. So it's good to see that happening in our field too. And we're not alone, but I think the universities, as they grapple with helping people understand what our impact and our role is, part of that is going back to show how we do connect with public problem solving, public problems. I see a lot of folks taking on and really embracing identities as public scholars. And that's so very important at this moment in history.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you initially gave an introduction to yourself, you mentioned a couple of hats and sort of a couple areas where you have work that's ongoing, including overseeing how the university considers community. So can you talk a bit about what projects you have actively going on right now and sort of where your work in this current moment is situated?
So right now, in terms of research on my team, we have a few projects going that I'm really passionate about. One is looking at the problem of brain injuries among women after domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And for that project, we have been partnering with the Rose Andam Center, which is a family justice center here in Denver, Colorado. And we've been doing a study broadly on women's health. And within that broad umbrella, we've been asking women about brain injuries caused either by strangulation or by a blow to the head. And what we're seeing is really quite startling in terms of very high percentages of women seeking services after intimate partner violence reporting significant injuries to the head that resulted in things like changes in consciousness. So that's how you would essentially screen for what would count is at least a mild traumatic brain injury. Work builds on work we did many years ago with Denver Police Department and the DA's office and community-based agencies, where we were looking at multidisciplinary team response to domestic violence cases reported to law enforcement. And as part of that project, we had a screener for head injuries and found that about a little more than one in two women had what was likely a mild traumatic brain injury. This has been a topic that I've been really passionate about because brain injuries, of course, can have an impact on everything, all aspects of life, from how one processes the world, sort of memory and attention, through to emotions. It can have an impact on education and career. And so this project is one that I'm really invested in for trying to figure out the scope of the problem among women seeking services after intimate partner violence.
Absolutely. That's a staggering number to hear. And I imagine a wildly misunderstood or just not understood area of service provision for survivors and just like understanding the experience of violence in relationships.
Yeah, I think we're among several research groups across the country now trying to shine a light on the problem of brain injuries. I think our colleagues in the practice world have been onto this for a while and are starting to look at ways to integrate screening and so forth into victim services. And one of the issues is we don't have a lot of good research yet to guide practice going forward. So once you screen and discover that women have histories of brain injuries, next question is, what do we do about it, particularly in the context of such limited services in many communities? When and for whom and under what conditions is it important to be addressing the head injury?
Absolutely. I imagine there's a long road ahead of understanding that. And even in that, we know collecting data comes with its own challenges, let alone a population that is experiencing the after effects of trauma and helping people to understand what it means to collect data too within that community as well is a step that has to be considered and takes time too. It's not the most maybe simple of processes, not that it should be. So thinking of the other work that you have, do you have another research project that you're looking toward or gathering data on too?
Well, I have a culminating project that I'm pretty excited about. My new book released called Every 90 Seconds, Our Common Cause, Ending Violence Against Women.
And congratulations.
Thank you. This one was certainly a labor of love in the sense that it really, across my career, we have had studies like the one I alluded to that has looked at brain injury and health problems to access to the criminal legal system. We've had other projects looking at education and career kind of impacts. And Every 90 Seconds was my effort to bring together those threads and really try to connect the dots of the ways that violence against women is tangled up with the big public problems of our time, whether it's education reform or legal reform, health healthcare access, economic inequities, to make the case to researchers and policymakers and the general public that we all share a stake in working together to end violence against women and girls, that this is not a women's issue. It's not a special interest issue. This is all of our issue because it's tangled up with the things that diminish our communities. And if we want communities to thrive, we need to help girls and women to thrive as well.
Absolutely. In the process of pulling that together and presenting it in a book format, what do you think was your, I guess, biggest takeaway or learning in that process, both on a, I maybe uncovered or thought about this thing differently, but also learning how you present information in that format too? Again, just noting that writing a book is not something that everyone can do all the time. And so it's a tough and long process.
I think there were many lessons learned because it was sure a long journey. When I think about sort of what I learned about violence against women by having the opportunity to step back and reflect, I think what stands out most is sort of back to the pathways question of how did I get into this business anyway? And I think early on, it really seemed to me in my much younger years that if people really understood the scope of the problem of violence against women, things would change and that we were sort of one public education campaign away from transformational change. That view really became tarnished over the years and in writing the book. And I became much more focused on how do we shift from awareness to helping people understand their stake in the issue so that they're interested in collaborating with us to take action. So this arc from awareness to action became much more where I was focusing in my writing and in my heart. So that's one lesson that comes to mind. And when you ask more about the process of writing, psychologists, we're trained to write journal articles. If we do books, they tend to be edited volumes for other academics.
And sure.
So this project was so important to me because it was the next step in my own development as a public scholar. I've been over the years trying to do more writing for public audiences, op-eds and things like that. And this book is intended for a broad audience. And it's my deepest hope that people who maybe didn't know they cared much about psychology or criminal justice or violence against women can pick it up and find it accessible as well as hopeful or how we build a path forward.
That's amazing. I look forward to being able to read it. So congratulations on that. Speaking then to the administrative hat and bridging that gap into the scholarship you have and then into the administrative functions that you also serve in, can you speak to the work that you have going on in that realm as well?
Yeah. So these community university partnerships have been so central to my research and teaching. About a decade ago, I got involved in our university Center for Community Engagement as their faculty director. And in that role, I discovered a couple of things. One was that my optimism for community university collaboration done well is sort of limitless, that if we can find ways to support equitable partnerships between communities and universities, I think there's just such tremendous potential for understanding issues and solving problems together. So I discovered that passion. I also discovered a passion for helping, supporting my colleagues, graduate students, undergraduates, and faculty and staff as well, to be prepared to enter into equitable partnerships. And so I really came to love the sort of administrative work that is about supporting a scholar's development, finding ways to overcome barriers to partnership, and imagining sort of into existence the kind of university that I want to be part of, which is one that has a really strong collaborative footprint in terms of its potential for public good.
Yeah. Absolutely. When you speak to the role of higher education and sort of universities and colleges in that way, it is such an important reminder of the connection that higher education can have and does have, right? Like when schools and institutions are in certain locations, right, they impact the things around them. And the ability to bridge those connections ultimately strengthens that stability and also to an extent kind of paves values or maybe honors the relationship that is developed out of almost the taking up of space in that way, right? That there is a benefit, a relationship that exists naturally between the institution and the location and the communities that it's in, but also that there is such knowledge generation happening and such availability of resources that colleges and universities have just by the folks that they're bringing in, the students that they're bringing in, the options for learning, the options for growth, and being able to figure out the best ways to share that, to learn in those ways, can only strengthen both parties in that way. So I could talk about university collaborations for a very long time because, right, I think institutions have such wonderful, but also they hold a lot of power ultimately and a lot of leverage. And the more that's recognized, I think ultimately the better.
Yeah. As you say, there's so much potential, and with potential is the potential for both positive and negative impact. And so,
yeah.
It is really important that universities approach this work through a lens of equity and are thinking about how we show up in and with communities to do work, how we negotiate projects so that they're mutually beneficial, how we think about shared risk and responsibility, and that being in a cost-benefit ratio that it makes it of benefit to community. Because we certainly, as universities, have at times over history approached communities with much more taking than offering.
Absolutely. Thinking of that, because it could fuel your answer to this question, but when you think about the field and sort of next steps and gaps in the work, what do you see as the biggest sort of next phase or next step that you'd want to see research scholars funding kind of paying attention to?
Great question. I have two thoughts. One is more specific, a narrower focus area, which would be that I think brain injury related research in intimate violence is really lacking, that we need a lot more to guide practitioners, inform policymakers, and that we're at this sort of critical junction where practice is changing quite quickly to try to keep up with recognizing the scope of the problem. And we don't yet have data that our colleagues as practitioners can make use of to guide limited resources. So that's one thought. I think my other thought for investments in the field is I have become really passionate about multidisciplinary responses to violence. And one way of thinking about that is through things like community coordinated responses that bring together multiple kinds of agencies and disciplines together to respond to violence in our communities. But I would love to see us push the envelope even further in how we think about which disciplines should be at the tables and how we do research on those tables. So for example, we have been slower as a field to figure out how to work with our colleagues in businesses and how to think about business interests in having policies that are responsive to employees who might be victims of domestic violence, for example. And so I think the more that we can start even broadening our frame for interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work and doing research on what comes of that when we open up that frame is really important. I learned a lot from colleagues in a project where we were looking at older adult abuse about the potential for things like your local bank manager to be somebody important in terms of the welfare of older adults in our community, that might be the person who is the first to notice that an older adult might be being taken advantage of financially. And that isn't the person that we've often thought of in the violence and abuse literature as, they wouldn't be our first thought as a partner.
Right, right.
How do we keep widening this disciplinary lens with funding to research and understand the impact of having many of us invested in detecting and responding to violence?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of what you said at the start of our conversation around, again, your pathway and being in an internship and sort of seeing in every one of your rotations that the experiences of trauma, the experiences of abuse are in so many sectors, whether it was an internship focused just on that or not, you're seeing it show up no matter what. I think it's hard because while we know that to be true, I'm sympathetic on the other side that a lot of folks are like, well, how can I learn something else, right? How do I tell the bank teller that we want them to be more aware of signals related to violence? Some folks are open to that. Some institutions are open to their employees having that kind of experience. Others, it is more of a hurdle I can be somewhat sympathetic to, in the sense that folks feel like they don't have that kind of skill, that kind of knowledge, that kind of time. There's a vision that it's an extra burden. So I think it's such an important and true point that, right, we see this across the spectrum, no matter what field you're in. But supporting institutions and individuals to feel comfortable as a possible first indicator, and how do we support people to know what to do in those situations and also not feel like that they just don't have the capacity for it in a personal space, right? I would argue the structural element of that can be adjusted to support it. But it's a challenge, I think, in the field of how do we message that? How do we train on that? How do we support folks to have a greater understanding that there are a lot of ways that the person who might be the first level of understanding or signs, recognizing what's going on, it's highly likely they're not the person that we're necessarily thinking it's going to be. The path to change doesn't necessarily come with the service provision after the fact. They're so important, but the change over time is hopefully the wonderful goal of no one needing those services because the thing hasn't occurred to require it.
You know, I think your comments really point out how key collaboration is. This isn't about everybody having to be an expert in everything. And we see that on research teams and how those have evolved over time, that it's more and more the case that the interesting questions you might want to ask as a researcher require you to be collaborating with people with complementary expertise. And I think the same is true in the solution side of the equation in terms of public problem solving, and that it isn't necessarily the case that everybody has to become an expert in intimate violence. But here's the thing, whether the bank teller or the small business owner, whether they know about intimate violence or not, it's having an impact on their employees, their constituents, their customers. And so how can we help people understand that, that just not knowing or not looking at it doesn't make it go away?
It should make it different.
So if that's the case, then how do we seed the kind of innovative collaborations that address the problem you're speaking to of, we can't all be experts in everything. But I think we have some really nice models of how collaboration could be an answer here.
Can you mention one of those models so that for those who might be interested in listening, might be able to do some more of their own research on learning more about what could work?
Yeah, so we've been doing some work with an organization called the Rocky Mountain Victim Law Center here in Denver. They are a statewide organization focused on legal issues. And several years ago, I joined their collaboration as a research partner as part of a project where they were trying to build wraparound legal services for crime victims. And what we realized was that there wasn't just an area or two of legal service needs that victims had. Instead, there were kind of these overwhelming barriers to getting legal needs met, the lack of information about legal needs, lack of services. And we realized that the grants that we had, and in the future, there was never going to be enough funding, say, to just put lawyers in every agency. And instead, the RMVLC, my colleagues and in the project, which became the Legal Information Network of Colorado, or LINC, what they started looking at was, how can we prepare people who are in different kinds of victim service provider roles to spot legal issues when they come up and make referrals, make a warm handoff to an agency that can address that issue? So it was this lovely example of, yes, giving people access to new information, but not asking them to become lawyers, just asking them to spot issues in a new way, do their work with a different framework in order to make sure that there wasn't a wrong door for victims, that if they walked through a social service agency door seeking counseling and also were about to get evicted from their home because a landlord was frustrated with too many domestic violence calls, that somebody could spot that before they ended up living in their car and get them connected with legal resources to fight the eviction. So it doesn't require everybody to become lawyers, but it does allow us as a community to better respond to legal issues in the many ways they show up.
Thank you. I think that's such a helpful illustration of how that can work and can calm or maybe at least address some of those immediate hesitancies that folks have. If someone were to give you just an unrestricted pot of money and limitless pot of money, so it could really do anything, what would you naturally within the in your work field, you know? Yeah. We might all go on a wonderful vacation, but if it was work related and research related and within your area, what would you use that for? Just knowing that there wasn't sort of limitations on what you had to produce or had to show or like how you had to show that work, I guess.
Yeah. I think with unrestricted resources, I would really be drawn to the kind of work where we're testing these complex interdisciplinary collaborations and what that can mean for trauma-informed policies and practices in organizations. So I think when you look at some of our intervention work, because intervention work is expensive, we tend to be very conservative in how questions are set up. And we don't necessarily get to test the messiness, which it can be both a downside and also have a lot of potential for change, that is the reality of these kind of interdisciplinary collaborations. So, you know, I would love to be able to look at what that kind of navigator model that my LINC colleagues developed, what would that look like in other spaces in terms of preparing people to spot other kind of trauma impacts and make referrals? And how does that affect the trajectory of victims and survivors' lives? If they pass through one door and don't end up with an unmet need there because somebody spotted an issue that could be addressed someplace else. So I think I'd be all in for the messier questions around collaboration and its real world impact. And then sort of back to your comments, I'd be really interested in work that could look at what does it take for a bank manager or a small business owner or after school program coach for them to really see preventing and responding to violence as their issue. What is that? What is the expertise they need? And where is the potential for collaboration?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I also, it's very much my stock response, but you know, I to folks of just like, if we speak it out, if we say it into the world, maybe that means that it'll happen, it'll come true. But regardless, I think as much as it's just a helpful wrap-up question to these conversations, it is also really important to discuss the ways in which folks are not typically answering something that is totally unreasonable. Like, I mean, I wouldn't even put that boundary on it, but in the sense that I would hope the future of research, the future of funding, considers some ways in which we can allow for more innovation and nuance and creativity isn't necessarily what I mean, but like a focus on what has not maybe been traditional in the ways that we see funding distributed, in the ways that we see funding legitimized, the way we consider legitimate work or sort of the almost the means testing that we put out related to projects and how we think even about research questions, how we even come to the ideas for research questions. And so I think it's also on a more practical basis, answering and hearing folks' response to the question is also just helpful to think about how we can expand the limitations of standard project structures. And again, what we are advocating on a higher level, where funding could be more impactful and more useful and where we can expand our thinking in that way. Thank you so much for your time. Is there any last things or parts that you'd want to share that we weren't able to talk about yet?
No, I really appreciate the conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Yes.